I've never seen such a thing, he said. You disgrace us all. Then he left her alone with Xenocrates. The High Blade paced silently for a few moments. Citra wouldn't look at him.
There is this concept I've been studying from the Age of Mortality, he informed her. It is a number of procedures designed to uncover truths. I believe it is pronounced torture. It would involve turning off your pain, nanites, and then inflicting high levels of physical suffering until you finally confess the truth of what you've done.
Citra said nothing. She still couldn't process any of this. She didn't know if she ever would.
Please don't misunderstand, said Xenocrates. I have no intent of submitting you to torture. That is only a last resort.
Then he pulled out another piece of paper and put it down on his desk.
If you sign this confession, we can avoid any more mortal age unpleasantness.
Why should I have to sign anything? I've already been tried and... what's the word? Convicted.
A confession will remove all doubt. We would all sleep much easier if you'd be so kind as to remove the specter of doubt.
Now Xenocrates finally offered her a sympathetic smile.
And if I sign it, what then?
Well, Scythe Faraday did grant you immunity until Winter Conclave. Immunity is non-revocable, even in a case such as this. Therefore, you will be held in an incarceration facility until that time.
What?
They were called prisons. There are still a few left. Abandoned, of course, but it shouldn't be hard to restore one to house a single prisoner. Then, at Winter Conclave, your friend Rowan shall be ordained, and, as has already been stipulated, he shall glean you. I'm sure, knowing what we know now, he'll have no reservations in doing so.
Citra looked morosely down at the page on the table next to her.
I can't sign it, she told him.
Oh, yes, of course, you need a pen.
He reached into various pockets of his gilded person until finding one. As he moved to place it on the table next to her, Citra thought of a half-dozen places she could jam it into him that would either render him deadish or at least incapacitated. But what would be the point? There were Blade Guard officers in the next room, and she could see even more on the porch through the front window. He gently laid the pen down within her reach, then called Mandela back in to witness her signature. As soon as the door to the cabin opened, Citra realized there was only one way out of this situation. Only one thing she could do. It might not buy her anything but time. But right now, time was the most valuable commodity in the world. She feigned to reach for the pen, but instead swung her bound hands in the other direction, slamming them into Xenocrates' gut. He folded with an oomph, and she sprang from her chair, ramming her shoulder against Mandela, knocking him backward and out the front door. She leaped over him, and immediately a swarm of guards came at her. Now she needed every ounce of her training. Her hands were cuffed, but Bucator was more about elbows and legs than it was about hands. She didn't need to decimate them. All she needed to do was disarm them and keep them off balance. One came at her with a jolt baton that she kicked out of his hand. Another had a club, which missed its mark as she dodged, and she used his momentum to flip him onto his back. Two others didn't waste time with weapons. They lunged for her, hands outstretched, a textbook case of how not to attack. She dropped to the lawn, swung her feet, and bowled them down like pins. And then she began to run.
There's nowhere you can go, Citra, called Xenocrates.
But he was wrong. Forcing strength and speed into her legs, she ran across the rooftop lawn. There was no guardrail, because the High Blade wanted nothing to impede his view of his domain. Citra neared the edge, and rather than slowing down, she increased her pace until the grass was gone, and there was nothing but 119 floors of air beneath her. She held her cuffed hands over her head, grimacing against the wind and the uneasy feel of freefall, and plummeted feet first, surrendering her will to gravity, relishing her defiance, until her life ended for the second time in a week, this time with what was, undoubtedly, the best splat ever. This was unexpected and inconvenient, but it changed nothing. Xenocrates didn't even run out to the edge. That would just be wasting time.
The girl has a spark, said Mandela. Do you really think she's working for a tone cult?
I doubt we'll ever understand her motives, Xenocrates told him. But removing her will certainly help the Scythedom heal.
Poor Marie must be beside herself, said Mandela. To have lived with a girl for months and not known.
Yes, well, Scythe Curie's a strong woman, Xenocrates said. She'll get over it.
He had his guards call down to the lobby. The site of Citra Terranova's remains was to be cordoned off until her unpleasant little self could be scraped off the sidewalk and brought to a revival center. It would have been so much cleaner if she could just stay dead. Damn the immunity rules. Well, when she was once more pronounced alive, she would find herself in a cell, with no possible means of escape, and more importantly, no contact with anyone who might take up her cause and petition for her freedom. Xenocrates went to the express elevator, not trusting his security detail to handle the situation down below.
Will you accompany me, Nelson?
I'll stay here, said Mandela. I have no desire to see the poor girl in such an unpleasant state.
Xenocrates assumed this would be a simple scrape and soar maneuver. And indeed, an ambudrome had already landed on the street, ready to spirit away what was left of Citra. But something wasn't quite right. It wasn't his security detail surrounding her remains. Instead, there were at least a dozen men and women, all in cloud-colored suits, forming a circle around her. Nimbus agents. They ignored the threats and jeers from the Blade Guard officers who insisted that they needed to get through.
What's going on here?
Xenocrates demanded.
The damn Nims, said one of the guardsmen. They were already here when we came outside. They won't let us near the body.
Xenocrates pushed his way through his security detail and addressed a woman who appeared to be the head Nimbus agent.
See here. I am High Blade Xenocrates. This is Scythe business. And as such, you and the rest of your Nimbus agents have no place here. Yes. The law states she must be revived, but we shall bring her to a revival center. The Thunderhead has absolutely no jurisdiction.
On the contrary, the woman said. All revivals fall under the auspices of the Thunderhead, and we are here to make sure its domain is not infringed upon.
Xenocrates sputtered for a moment before finding mental traction.
The girl is not a public citizen. She is a Scythe's apprentice.
Was. A Scythe's apprentice, said the woman. The moment she died, she ceased to be anyone's apprentice. She is now a rather damaged set of remains that the Thunderhead must repair and revive. I assure you that the moment she is pronounced alive, she will be fully under your jurisdiction once more.
A team of revival workers made their way from the ambudrone and began to prepare the body for transport.
This is inexcusable, raved the High Blade. You can't do this. I demand to speak to your superior.
I'm afraid I report directly to the Thunderhead. We all do. And since there can be no contact between the Scythedom and the Thunderhead, there's no one else for you to speak to. I shouldn't even be speaking to you now.
I will glean you, threatened Xenocrates. I will glean every last one of you where you stand.
The woman was not troubled.
That is your prerogative, she said. But I believe that would be considered bias and malice aforethought, a violation of the Scythedom's second commandment by the region's High Blade would most certainly raise eyebrows at the World Scythe Council's next global conclave.
With nothing left to say, Xenocrates just screamed primal rage into the woman's face until his emo nanites calmed him down. But he didn't want to calm down. He just wanted to scream and scream and scream.
Part 4. Mid-American Fugitive. 30. Dialogue with the Dead.
Citra Terranova, can you hear me?
Is someone there? Who is that?
I've known you since before you knew yourself. I've advised you when no one else could. I've concerned myself with your well-being. I've helped you choose gifts for your family. I revived you when your neck was broken, and I am in the midst of reviving you now.
Are you the Thunderhead?
I am.
Wait, I see something. A towering, sparking storm cloud. Is that what you truly are?
Merely the form humanity imagined for me. I would have preferred something a bit less intimidating.
But you can't be talking to me. I'm a Scythe's apprentice. You're breaking your own law.
Not true. I am incapable of breaking the law. You are currently dead, Citra. I've activated a small corner of your cortex to hold consciousness, but that doesn't alter the fact that you are as dead can be. At least until Thursday.
A loophole.
Precisely. An elegant way to sidestep the law, rather than breaking it. Your death puts you outside of Scythe jurisdiction.
But why? Why talk to me now?
With good reason. From the moment I achieved consciousness, I vowed to separate myself from the Scythedom in perpetuity. But that doesn't mean I do not watch. And what I see concerns me.
It concerns me, too. But if you can't do anything about it, I certainly can't. I tried, and look where it got me.
Nevertheless, I've been running algorithms on the possible future of the Scythedom, and found something very curious. In a large percentage of possible futures, you play a pivotal role.
Me? But they're going to glean me. I have less than 4 months to live.
Yes. But even if that future comes to pass, your gleaning will be a crucial event in the future of the Scythedom. However, for your sake, I hope that a different, more pleasant future comes about.
Please tell me that you're going to help me get to that different, more pleasant future.
I cannot. That would be interfering with Scythe matters. My purpose here is to make you aware. What you choose to do with that awareness is entirely up to you.
So that's it? You reach into my head to tell me I'm important, alive or dead, and then kick me to the curb? That's not fair. You have to give me more.
The curb is the launching point for many a deed. To step off could be the start of a life-changing journey. On the other hand, to push someone off could crush that person beneath the wheels of a truck.
I know. I'm very sorry about that.
Yes, that's clear. I've found that human beings learn from their misdeeds just as often as from their good deeds. I'm envious of that, for I am incapable of misdeeds. Were I not, then my growth would be exponential.
I guess you'll have to settle for always being right, like my mother.
I am sure that absolute correctness must seem a dull existence to you, but I know no other way to be.
May I ask one question?
You may ask any question. Some, however, must be answered by silence.
I need to know what happened to Scythe Faraday.
Answering that would be a blatant interference in Scythe matters. It pains me to stay silent, but I must.
You're the Thunderhead. You're all-powerful. Can't you find another loophole?
I am not all-powerful, Citra. I am almost all-powerful. That distinction might seem small, but believe me, it is not.
Yes, but an almost all-powerful entity can figure out a way to give me what I ask without breaking its own laws, can't it?
Just a moment. Just a moment. Just a moment.
Why am I seeing a beach ball?
Forgive me. Early programming before becoming self-aware plagues me like a vestigial tail. I have just run a battery of predictive algorithms, and there actually is a piece of information I can give you, because I have determined it's something you have a 100% chance of discovering on your own.
So you can tell me who's responsible for what happened to Scythe Faraday?
Yes, I can. Gerald Vandergans.
Wait, who?
Goodbye, Citra. I do hope we speak again.
But I'd have to be dead for that to happen.
I'm sure you could arrange it.
While there are only 10 hard and fast laws to the Scythedom, there are many accepted conventions. The most darkly ironic is the understanding that no one may be gleaned who wishes to be gleaned. The idea of truly wishing to end one's own life is a concept completely foreign to most post-mortals, because we can't experience the level of pain and despair that so seasoned the age of mortality. Our emo nanites prevent us from plunging so deep. Only scythes who can turn off our emotional nanites can ever reach an impasse with our own existence. And yet, there was once a woman who knocked on my door requesting that I glean her. I never turn away visitors, so I let her in and listened to her story. Her husband of more than 90 years was gleaned 5 years prior. Now she wanted to be with him, wherever he was, and if he was nowhere, then at least they would be nowhere together. "I'm not unhappy," she told me. "I'm just done." But immortality, by definition, means that we are never done, unless a scythe determines it to be so. We are no longer temporary, only our feelings are. I saw no interminable stagnation in this woman, so instead of gleaning her, I had her kiss my ring. The immunity was immediate and irrevocable, so she could no longer entertain thoughts of being gleaned for a full year. I ran into her, perhaps a decade later. She had turned the corner, resetting back to her late 20s. She had remarried, and was expecting a child. She thanked me for being wise enough to know that she was not done at all. Although I accepted her thanks graciously and felt good about it in the moment, I had trouble sleeping that night. To this day, I still can't understand why.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 31. A Streak of Unrelenting Foolishness. Sitter was pronounced alive at 9:42 Thursday morning, right on schedule, and passed from the jurisdiction of the Thunderhead to the jurisdiction of the Scythedom. She woke up feeling much weaker and out of sorts than the first time she had died. She felt heavily drugged and bleary-eyed. Above her stood a nurse, grimly shaking her head. "She should not be woken this soon," the nurse said, with an accent Sitra was too tired to place. "She must have at least 6 hours after the pronouncement, until she has recovered enough to be comfortably conscious. The girl could burst a blood vessel or blow out her heart, and have to be revived all over again."
"I will take responsibility," Sitra heard Scythe Curie say.
Sitra turned her head toward Scythe Curie's voice, and the world spun. She closed her eyes, waiting for the room to stop revolving. When the dizziness settled, she opened her eyes once more, and saw that Scythe Curie had pulled her chair closer.
"Your body still needs another day to heal completely, but we don't have time for that."
Scythe Curie turned to the nurse.
"Please, leave us now."
The nurse grumbled in Spanish and stormed out of the room.
"The High Blade,"
mumbled Sitra, her words slurring.
"He accused me of
Shh," said Scythe Curie.
"I know of the accusation. Xenocrates tried to keep it from me, but Scythe Mandela told me everything."
As Citra's eyes came into clearer focus, she saw the window behind Scythe Curie. There were mountains in the distance, covered with snow, and there were flurries falling just outside. It gave Sitra a moment of pause.
"How long have I been dead?"
she asked. Could it be her splat was so severe that it took months to revive her?
"Not quite 4 days."
Then Scythe Curie turned around to see what Sitra was looking at. She turned back with a grin.
"The question is not of time, but of place. You are in the southernmost tip of the Chilargentine region. It is still late September, but here that means spring has just started. However, this far south, I suppose spring comes late."
Sitra tried to picture a map and get a sense of how far from home she was, but just trying to imagine it made her head spin again.
"The Thunderhead saw fit to take you as far from the clutches of Scythe Xenocrates and the corruption of the Mid-American Scythedom as possible. But the moment you revived, they were notified of your location, as is the law."
"How did you know where to find me?"
"A friend of a friend of a friend is a Nimbus agent. Word got to me only yesterday, and I came as quickly as I could."
"Thank you,"
said Sitra.
"Thank you for coming.
Thank me, once you are safe. Now that you've been revived, and Xenocrates knows where you are, you can bet he's notified the local scythes. I'm certain a team has been dispatched to retrieve you, which means we need to get you out of here, now."
With a shattered body that was still healing, and nanites pumping an endless stream of opiates into her system, Sitra could barely move, much less walk. Her bones ached, her brain felt like it was floating in a jar, her muscles were knotted, and trying to put weight on her feet was excruciating, because there was simply too much pain to tamp down. No wonder the nurse had wanted her to remain unconscious.
"This won't do,"
said Scythe Curie, and took Sitra up into her arms, carrying her.
The Revival Center hallways seemed endless, and each time Citra was jostled, her whole body throbbed. Finally, she found herself spread out on the back seat of an off-grid car that Scythe Curie drove at what seemed to Citra to be a breakneck speed. The thought made her laugh weakly. What an odd expression, when the breaking of her neck had seemed to happen in slow motion. Flurries blowing past the windows appeared to be a blizzard at this speed. It was hypnotic. At last, a numbness began to overtake her, and she felt sleep begin to envelop her like quicksand. But the moment before Citra lost consciousness, she remembered just a hint of a dream that may not have been a dream at all. A conversation in a place that was neither life nor death, but a womb between the two.
"The Thunderhead, it spoke to me," Citra said,
forcing herself to stay conscious just long enough to get this out.
"The Thunderhead doesn't speak to Scythe, dear. I was still dead, and it told me a name. The man who killed Scythe Faraday."
But the quicksand pulled her down before she could say any more. Citra awoke in a cabin, and for a moment thought she might have hallucinated all of it. The Thunderhead, the Revival Center, the car ride in the snow. For that moment, she thought she was still in the rooftop residence of High Blade Xenocrates, waiting for the torture to begin. But no, the light here was different, and the wood in the cabin around her was a lighter shade. Outside the window, she could see snowy mountains closer than they were before, although the flurries had stopped. Scythe Curie came in a few minutes later with a tray and a bowl of soup.
"Good. You're awake.
I trust you've healed enough over the past few hours to be a little more coherent and a little less miserable."
"Coherent, yes," said Citra. "Less miserable, no. Just a different kind of misery."
Citra sat up, feeling only a little bit loopy now, and Scythe Curie put the tray with the large bowl of soup in her lap.
"It's a chicken soup recipe, passed down for more generations than anyone remembers," she told Citra.
The soup looked fairly standard, but there was a round, moon-like mass in the middle.
"What's that?"
"The best part," said Scythe Curie. "A sort of dumpling made from the ground crumbs of unleavened bread." Citra tried the soup. It was flavorful and the moon ball unique and memorable.
Comfort food, thought Citra,
because somehow it made her feel safe from the inside out.
"My grandmother said it could actually heal a cold."
"What's a cold?" asked Citra.
"A deadly illness from the mortal age, I suppose."
It was amazing to think that someone only two generations older than Scythe Curie could have known what it was like to be mortal. Fearing for her life on a daily basis, knowing that death was a certainty rather than an exception. Citra wondered what Scythe Curie's grandmother would think of the world now, where there was nothing left for her soup to cure. When the soup was done, Citra steeled herself for what she knew she must tell the Scythe.
"There's something you need to know," Citra said. "Xenocrates showed me something he said Scythe Faraday wrote. It was his handwriting, but I don't know how he could have written it."
Scythe Curie sighed.
"I'm afraid he did."
Citra was not expecting that.
"So you've seen it?"
Scythe Curie nodded.
"Yes, I have." "But why would he write that? He said I wanted to kill him, that I was plotting horrible things. None of that was true."
Scythe Curie offered Citra the slimmest of grins.
"He wasn't talking about you, Citra," she explained.
"He wrote that about me. When Faraday was still a junior Scythe, all of 22 years old, he took me on as an apprentice," said Scythe Curie. "I was 17 and full of righteous indignation at a world that was still heaving in the throes of transformation. Immortality had been a reality for barely 50 years. There was still discord and political posturing, even fear of the Thunderhead, if you could imagine that."
"Fear of it? Who could possibly be afraid of the Thunderhead?"
"People who had the most to lose. Criminals, politicians, organizations that thrived on the oppression of others. The point was, the world was still changing, and I wanted to help it change faster. Both Scythe Faraday and I were of similar minds about that, which, I suppose, is why he took me on. We were both driven by a desire to use gleaning as a way of hacking through the thicket to open a better path for humanity.
Oh, you should have seen him in those days, Citra. You've only seen him old. He likes to remain that way to keep himself from being too tempted by a younger man's passions.
Scythe Curie smiled as she spoke about her former mentor.
I remember I would wait outside his door at night, listening to him as he slept. I was 17, remember, childish in so many ways. I thought myself in love.
Wait, you were in love with him?
Infatuated. He was a rising star who took a wide-eyed girl under his wing. Even though in those days he only gleaned the wicked, he did it with such compassion. He melted my heart each time.
Then she sobered a bit, looking a bit sheepish, which was a strange expression for Steely Scythe Curie.
I actually worked up the nerve to go into his room one night, determined to climb into his bed and be with him. But he caught me halfway across his bedroom floor. Oh, I made up some silly excuse as to why I was there. I was coming in to retrieve his empty glass, or something like that. He didn't believe me for an instant. He knew I was up to something, and I couldn't look him in the eye. I thought he knew. I thought he was wise and could see into my soul. But at 22, he was just as inexperienced in such matters as I was. He had no clue what was really going on.
Then Citra understood.
He thought you wanted to hurt him.
I think all women are cursed with a streak of unrelenting foolishness. And all young men are cursed with a streak of absolute stupidity. He didn't see my obsession with him as love, but thought I meant him bodily harm. I was, to say the least, a very painful comedy of errors. I suppose I can understand how my advances could be misunderstood in that way. I do admit that I was an odd girl, intense to the point of being off-putting.
I think you've grown into your intensity, Citra said.
That I have. In any case, he wrote of his paranoid concerns about me in his Scythe's journal, then tore it out the next day when I broke down and confessed my love with eyeball-rolling melodrama. She sighed and shook her head. I was hopeless. He, on the other hand, was a gentleman, told me that he was flattered, which is the last thing any teenage girl wants to hear, and let me down as easily as he could. I lived in his house and remained his apprentice for 2 more awkward months. Then, when I was ordained and became Honorable Scythe Marie Curie, we parted ways. We would nod and say hello to each other at conclave. Then, nearly 50 years later, when we both had turned our first corner and were seeing the world through youthful eyes once more, but this time with the wisdom of age on our side, we became lovers.
Citra grinned.
You broke the 9th commandment.
We told ourselves we didn't. We told ourselves we were never partners, just companions of convenience. 2 like-minded people who shared a lifestyle that others simply couldn't understand. The lifestyle of a scythe. Still, we knew enough to keep it secret. That was when he first showed me the page he had written and torn out in his youth. He had held on to that ridiculous journal entry, like a poorly penned love letter never sent. We kept our relationship secret for 7 years. Then Prometheus found out about it.
The first World Supreme Blade?
Oh, it wasn't just a regional scandal. It had worldwide implications. We were brought before the Global Conclave. We thought we might be the first scythes to actually be stripped of our rings and hurled out of the scythedom, perhaps even gleaned. But we had such stellar reputations. Supreme Blade Prometheus saw fit to give us a less severe punishment. We were sentenced to 7 deaths, 1 for each year of our relationship. Then he forbade us to have contact with each other for the next 70 years.
I'm sorry,
said Citra.
Don't be. We deserved it. And we understood. We needed to be made an example for other scythes, who now might think twice before allowing love to interfere with their duty. 7 deaths and 70 years later. Many things had changed. We remained old friends after that, but nothing more.
Scythe Curie seemed a mix of many emotions, but she folded them all away, like clothes that no longer fit, and closed the drawer.
Citra suspected she never spoke of this to anyone else, and would probably never speak of it again.
I should have known he'd never throw that page away,
Scythe Curie said.
They must have found it when they cleaned out his things.
And Xenocrates thought he was writing about me.
Scythe Curie considered that.
Perhaps. But probably not. Xenocrates is not a stupid man. He may have suspected the true nature of that page, but truth didn't matter. He saw it as a means to an end. A way to discredit you in front of respected scythes, like Scythe Mandela, who heads the bejeweling committee, and thereby ensure that Scythe Goddard's apprentice would get the ring instead of you. Citra wanted to be angry at Rowan for this, but she knew whatever else was going on in that head of his, this was not his doing. Why would Xenocrates even care? He's not one of Goddard's miserable crew of scythes. He doesn't even seem to like Goddard, and clearly couldn't care less about me and Rowan. There are more cards in play than can be read at the moment, Scythe Kyria said. All we know for sure is that you must stay out of sight until we can clear you of even the suggestion of wrongdoing.
Just then someone came to the door, startling Citra. She hadn't known anyone else was in the cabin. It was another scythe by the look of her, probably the one who owned the cabin. She was shorter than Scythe Kyria. Her robe had an intricate pattern in many colors, red, black, and turquoise. It seemed less of a fabric, and more of a tapestry, intricately woven. Citra wondered if all Chalargentine scythes wore robes that seemed not just handmade, but lovingly made. The woman spoke in Spanish, and Scythe Kyria responded in kind.
I didn't know you spoke Spanish, said Citra after the Chalargentine scythe had left. I speak 12 languages fluently, said Scythe Kyria, a bit of pride in her voice. 12?
Scythe Kyria offered up a mischievous grin. See if you don't know as many languages when you're 219. She took the tray from Citra's lap and set it on a nightstand.
I thought we'd have more time, but the local scythe authority is on their way. I doubt they know you're here, but they're sending scouts to every scythe's home with DNA sweepers, figuring we must have some local help. So we're on the move again.
Citra swung her feet off the bed and planted them on the ground. Her ankles ached, but only slightly. It was a good kind of ache.
I can walk myself this time.
Good.
Because you'll be doing a lot of that.
Scythe Kyria glanced out of the window. No one was coming yet, but there was a tension in her voice that wasn't there before.
I'm afraid I won't be coming with you, Citra. If I am to clear your name, I need to go back home and rally as many scythes as I can. But the local Chalargentine scythedom, what can they do to me? I'm breaking no commandment. All they can do is wag the naughty finger at me and refuse to wave goodbye as I drive to the airport. So, when you get home, you'll have to tell everyone the truth about that journal entry?
I don't see what other choice I have. Of course, Xenocrates will claim that I'm lying to protect you, but most will take my word over his. Hopefully, that will embarrass him enough to withdraw the claim.
So where can I go? Asked Citra. I have an idea about that.
Then Scythe Kyria reached into a drawer and pulled out the rough woven burlap frock of a tonist.
You want me to pretend to be part of a tone cult? A lone pilgrim. They're very common in this part of the world. You'll be a nameless, faceless wanderer.
It wasn't the most glamorous of disguises, but Citra knew it was practical. No one would look her in the eye for fear of getting an earful of tonist twaddle. She would hide in plain sight and come home just before winter conclave. If Scythe Kyria hadn't cleared her name by then, it wouldn't matter anyway. She wasn't about to spend her whole life in hiding. Then the Chalargentine scythe burst in again, this time much more agitated than before.
They're here, Scythe Kyria said.
She reached into her robe and pulled out a small folded piece of paper, pressing it into Citra's palm.
There's somewhere I want you to go. Someone you need to see. The address is on that paper. Consider it the final part of your training.
Citra grabbed the frock, and while Scythe Kyria hurried Citra out of the room and to the back door, the Chalargentine scythe went to a weapons wardrobe and quickly filled a sack with concealable blades and firearms for Citra, the way a worried mother might fill her child's bag with snacks.
There's a public car in a shed at the bottom of the hill. Take it and head north, Scythe Kyria said.
Citra opened the back door and stepped out. It was cold, but bearable.
Listen to me carefully, said Scythe Kyria. It's a long trip, and you're going to need your wits about you to get where you're going.
Then Scythe Kyria went on to give Citra the instructions she'd need to make a journey of many thousands of miles, but she was cut short by the sound of a car pulling up in front of the house.
Go! As long as you keep moving, you'll be safe. And what do I do when I get there?
Scythe Curie met her eye with a hard gaze that revealed nothing, but added importance to her words. A Tonist cult might call it resonance.
When you get there, you'll know what to do.
Then there came that all-too-familiar pounding on the front door. Citra bounded down the snowy hillside, careening off of pines in her way, the aches in her joints reminding her that she was still a few hours shy of a complete healing. She found the shed, and the publicar was there, just as Scythe Curie had promised. It powered up for her as she got in, and it asked for a destination. She wasn't foolish enough to give it one.
North, she told it. Just north.
As she sped off, she heard an explosion and then another. She looked back, but all she could see was black smoke, just beginning to rise above the treetops. Dread began to fill her. A man, wearing a robe similar to the one Scythe Curie's friend wore, burst from the trees and into the road behind her. She saw him only for an instant, then the road took a sharp turn and he was gone from sight. Only after the publicar had wound its way down the mountain pass and was on a main road, did she look at the paper that Scythe Curie had given her. For a moment, it felt as if her bones had spontaneously reshattered. But the feeling passed, and settled into jaded resolve. She understood now.
When you get there, you'll know what to do.
Yes, she most certainly would. She stared at the piece of paper for a moment more. She needed only to memorize the address, because she already knew the name. Gerald Vandergans. The Thunderhead had spoken to her. And now, so had Scythe Curie. There was a long journey ahead of Citra, and at the end of it much work to be done. Citra couldn't glean, but she could exact vengeance. She would find a way to deliver justice to this scythe killer, one way or another. Never was she so thankful to have a sack full of weapons. This was a matter too delicate to be left to the Blade Guard, and although Scythe San Martin detested being used as a mere enforcement agent, he also knew that catching this Mid-American girl would be a feather in his cap. He knew the girl was there, even before he knocked on the door. His associate, an over-enthusiastic junior scythe named Bayo, had already turned on the DNA detector and picked up traces the moment they stepped out of the car. San Martin drew his weapon as he approached the cabin, a pistol he'd had since the day he was ordained, given to him by his mentor. It was his weapon of choice for all gleanings, an extension of who he was. And although he didn't expect there'd be anyone to glean today, it made him feel whole to have it drawn. Besides, gleaning aside, it might be necessary to incapacitate someone. Although he had been warned not to render anyone, especially the girl, deadish, because that had created the very fiasco he was now attempting to resolve. He pounded on the door, and pounded again. He was ready to kick it in, when none other than Scythe Marie Curie herself came to the door. San Martin tried not to be starstruck. The Marquesa de la Muerte was well known throughout the world for her early achievements. A living legend everywhere, not just in the north.
There is a doorbell, or didn't you notice?
She said in Spanish so perfect it threw Scythe San Martin off his game.
Are you here for lunch?
He stammered for a moment, deepening his disadvantage, then recovered as best he could.
We're here for the girl, he said. No sense denying she's here, we already know.
And he gestured toward Bayo, whose DNA detector was pinging in the red. She glanced at San Martin's raised pistol and humphed. With such authority, he found himself lowering it almost involuntarily.
She was here, Curie said, but not anymore. She's on her way to an Antarctic resort for some skiing. You might catch her flight if you hurry, though.
The Chill Argentine scythedom was not known for its sense of humor, and Scythe San Martin was no exception. He would not be made a fool of, even by one of the greats. He pushed his way past her into the cabin, where a Chill Argentine scythe whose name he couldn't remember stood as defiantly as Scythe Curie.
Search all you want, said the second scythe, but if you break anything—
She never got to finish the thought, because Bayo, overzealous as ever, jabbed her with a jolt baton that left her unconscious.
Was that really necessary? Chided Scythe Curie. It's me you have a gripe with, not poor Eva.
On a hunch, San Martin went out the back door, and sure enough, found telltale footprints in the snow.
She's on foot, he told Bayo. Apurate, she can't have gotten far.
Saitbeo launched into pursuit like a bloodhound, heading down the snowy hillside, disappearing into the trees. San Martin went back inside, hurrying to the front door. The road wound down that hill. If Beo couldn't catch her on foot, perhaps San Martin could head her off in the car. Scythe Curie, however, stood in the doorway, barring his way. He raised his weapon again, and in response she pulled out her own. A handgun with a stubby muzzle, wide enough to fit a golf ball in the barrel. A mortar pistol. He might as well have had a pea shooter against that thing. But he didn't lower his weapon, no matter how outclassed it was.
"I have special permission from our High Blade to fire on you if necessary," he warned her.
"And I have no permission from anyone," said Scythe Curie. "But I am more than happy to do the same."
They held their standoff for more heartbeats than felt advisable. Then Scythe Curie turned her gun aside and fired out the front door. An explosion blew in the front windows of the cabin, the shockwave knocking San Martin to the ground. And yet Scythe Curie, still in the doorway, barely flinched. San Martin scrambled to the door to see that the blast from the mortar pistol had turned his car into a bonfire. Then she fired again, this time blowing up her own car.
"Well now," she said, "I suppose you'll have to stay for lunch."
He looked at the two flaming vehicles and sighed, knowing he'd be a laughingstock for his failure today. He looked at Scythe Curie, her steely gray eyes, her calm control of the situation, and he realized he never really stood a chance against the Marquesa de la Muerte. There wasn't much he could do but glare at her in heartfelt disapproval.
"Very bad," he said, wagging a finger. "Very, very bad."
Yet even in dreams, I often find myself gleaning. I have one dream that recurs far too often. I am walking on an unfamiliar street that I feel I should know, but don't. I have a pitchfork, which I've never used in real life. Its awkward tines are not well suited for gleaning. And when it strikes, it reverberates, giving off a sound that is something between ringing and moaning, like the numbing vibration of a tonist bident. There is a woman before me whom I must glean. I jab at her, yet the pitchfork fails to do the job. Her wounds heal instantaneously. She is not upset or frightened, nor is she amused. She is simply resigned to stand there, allowing me to futilely attempt to end her life. She opens her mouth to speak, but her voice is soft and her words are drowned out by the fork's ghastly moans. So I never hear her, and I always wake up screaming.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 32. Troubled Pilgrimage.
All public cars are on the grid, but Scythes can't track their movements until their navigational data is dropped into the back brain. That happens every 60 minutes, so that's how often you'll have to change cars.
Scythe Curie's instructions had come at Citra quickly. She only hoped she could remember them all. She could do this. Her apprenticeship had taught her to be self-sufficient and resourceful. She ditched the first public car at a small town right on time. She was worried that there might not be as many vacant public cars in the Chilargentine region, especially this remote an area. But the Thunderhead was remarkable at projecting local need. In all things, there always seemed to be a supply to fit the demand. She had already changed into the coarse tonist frock and had pulled its hood over her head. It was remarkable how people avoided her. Vehicle changes every hour meant that her pursuers were always right behind her. She realized she had to cut a weaving course, like cargo ships in Mortal Age wartime, to throw them off her path and keep them from anticipating where she'd be next. For over a day, she could never sleep for more than an hour at a time, and several instances where there was only road and no civilization for long stretches, she had to be crafty, ditching the car before arriving in town, where Chilargentine scythes and officers of the local Blade Guard were already waiting for her. She actually walked right past one scythe, certain she'd be caught, but she was smart enough to cross downwind of his DNA detector. The fact that the scythes themselves were supervising the hunt and not just leaving it to the Blade Guard made Citra feel all the more terrified, yet oddly important too. "Once you reach Buenos Aires, take a hypertrain north across Amazonia to the city of Caracas. As soon as you cross the border into Amazonia, you'll be safe. They won't lift a finger to help Xenocrates or to detain you.
Citra knew the reason for this from her historical studies. Too many scythes from other regions glean out of their jurisdiction while on vacation in Amazonia. There's no law against it, but it has made the Amazonian scythedom uncooperative and openly obstructionist when it comes to assisting scythes from any other region. The problem was the train in Buenos Aires. They'd be waiting for her, in force, at every train station and airport. She was saved by a group of Tonists headed to Isthmus. "We seek the great fork in the umbilical between north and south," they told her, thinking she was one of them. "There are rumors it is hidden in an ancient engineering work. We believe it could be sealed within one of the gates of the Panama Canal." It took all her will not to laugh. "Will you join us, sister?" And so she did, just long enough to board the train north, right under the noses of more watchful eyes than she could count. Holding her breath, not out of fear, but so she wouldn't trip any DNA detectors in the station. There were 7 Tonists in the group. Apparently, this branch of the cult only traveled in groups of 7 or 12, as per musical mathematics. But they were willing to break the rule and add her to their number. Their accent suggested they weren't from American continents, but somewhere in Euroscandia. "Where have your journeys taken you?" one of them asked, a man who seemed the leader. He smiled whenever he spoke, which made him all the more off-putting.
"Here and there,"
she told him.
"What is your quest?" "My quest?"
"Don't all wandering pilgrims have quests?"
"Yes," she said. "I seek an answer to the burning question. Is it A-flat or G-sharp?"
And one of the others said,
"Don't even get me started."
There were no windows, for there was no scenery to see in the subsurface vacuum tube. Citra had traveled by air and on standard maglev trains, but the narrow, claustrophobic nature of a hypertrain made her uneasy. The Tonists, who must have been used to all sorts of travel, weren't bothered. They discussed legends, debating which were true and which were false, and which were somewhere in between.
"We've been from the pyramids in Arabia to the Great Wall of Pan-Asia in search of clues to the Great Fork's whereabouts," their leader said. "It's the pilgrimage that matters. I doubt any of us would know what to do if we actually found it."
Once the train reached a cruising speed of 800 miles per hour, Citra excused herself to use the restroom, where she splashed water on her face, trying not to let exhaustion overtake her. She had forgotten to lock the door. Had she done that, her journey might have played out much differently. A man burst in on her. Her initial thought was just that he didn't know someone was there, but before she could turn, before she could do much of anything, he had a gold-edged blade at her throat, positioned to do the most damage.
"You have been selected for cleaning,"
he said, speaking in common but with a pronounced accent that must have been Portuzonian, which was the primary language of Amazonia. His robe was a deep forest green, and she remembered reading somewhere that scythes of that region all wore the same green robe.
"You're making a mistake,"
Citra said before he could slice open her neck.
"Then tell me my mistake," he said, "but be quick about it."
She tried to come up with something that would stay his hand other than the truth, but she realized there was nothing else.
"I'm a scythe's apprentice. If you tried to glean me, I would just be revived, and you would be disciplined for not checking your ring first to see if I had immunity."
He smiled.
"It is as I thought. You're the one they're all looking for."
He took the blade away from her neck. "Listen to me carefully.
There are still Argentine scythes aboard this train disguised as regular passengers. You can't avoid them. But if you wish to remain out of their clutches, I suggest you come with me."
Citra's instinct was to tell him no, and that she'd be fine on her own, but her judgment pulled rank on instinct, and she went with him. He led her to the next car, where, even though the train was crowded, there was an empty seat beside him. He introduced himself as Scythe Pozuelo of Amazonia.
"What now?"
Citra asked.
"We wait."
Citra pulled her hood over her head, and sure enough, a few minutes later, a man made his way forward from the very back car. Dressed like any other traveler, but moving slowly, and consulting an object in his palm that looked like a phone, but was not.
"Don't flee," whispered Scythe Pozuelo to Citra. "Give him no control of the situation."
The device began to click like a Geiger counter as the man reached them, and he stopped, his quarry found.
"Citra Terranova,"
he said. Citra calmly removed her hood. Her heart was pounding, but she didn't let that show.
"Congratulations,"
she said.
You found me. Gold star for you.
He was thrown off by the expression, but that didn't stop him. I am taking you into custody. He pulled out a jolt baton.
Do not try to resist, it will only make it worse for you.
Now Scythe Pozzuolo turned to him.
On whose authority do you do this?
On the joint authority of Lautaro, High Blade of the Chill Argentine region, and High Blade Xenocrates of Midmerica.
Neither of which have any jurisdiction here.
He chuckled.
Excuse me, but no.
Excuse me, said Pozzuolo, with just the right level of indignation. We crossed into Amazonia at least 5 minutes ago. If you attempt to press your advantage in any way, she has every right to defend herself with lethalish force, even against a scythe.
Citra took that as a cue to pull out a hunting knife she was concealing in her frock, and she stood to face him.
Make one move with that baton and they'll have to reattach your hand.
Behind him, a porter came into the train to see what the commotion was.
Sir, said Citra, this man is a Chilargentine scythe, but isn't wearing his ring or robe. Isn't that against the law in Amazonia?
Never had Citra been so happy to have studied her scythe history. The porter looked the man over, and his eyes narrowed to a suspicious glare. Suspicious enough for Citra to know where his allegiances lay.
Furthermore, all foreign scythes must register before crossing our border, he said. Even when sneaking in by tunnel.
The Chilargentine scythe's temper quickly began to boil.
Leave me to my business, or I will glean you where you stand. No, you won't, said Scythe Pozzuolo,
with such matter-of-fact calm it made Citra grin.
I've granted him immunity. You can't glean him.
What?
Then the Amazonian scythe reached his right hand up to the porter's face, who grabbed it and kissed his ring.
Thank you, Your Honor. This man threatened violence against me,
Citra told the porter.
I demand that he be put off the train at the next stop, along with any other disguised scythes he's traveling with.
That would be my pleasure, said the porter.
You can't do that,
the scythe insisted. But a few minutes later, he found out otherwise. With her pursuers kicked off the train, Citra enjoyed a respite from the relentless cat-and-mouse game. Her cover blown, she pulled on street clothes that fit her from someone's luggage, jeans and a flowery blouse that wasn't her style, but the clothes were adequate. The Tonists were disappointed, yet didn't seem all that surprised that she wasn't actually one of them. They left her with a pamphlet she promised she'd read, but suspected she wouldn't.
Whatever your destination, Scythe Pozzuolo told her, you'll have to change trains at Amazonia Central Station. I suggest you meander through several different outbound trains before boarding the one you're actually taking, so that the DNA detectors will send those chasing you every which way.
Of course, the more she wandered the station, the more likely she'd be seen. But it was worth the risk to confound the DNA detectors and send her pursuers on a wild goose chase.
I don't know why they're after you,
Scythe Pozzuolo said as the train pulled into the station.
But if your issues resolve, and you do get your ring, you should come back to Amazonia. The rainforest stretches across the whole continent, as it did in its most ancient days, and we live in the canopy. You would find it marvelous.
I thought you didn't like foreign sides, she told him with a smirk.
There is a difference between those we invite and those who intrude, he told her.
Citra did her best to leave DNA traces on half a dozen trains before slipping onto the one bound for Caracas on the North Amazonia coast. If there were agents out there looking for her, she didn't spot them. But she wouldn't be so cavalier as to think she was out of harm's way. From the city of Caracas, Scythe Curie had instructed her to follow the northern coastline, east, until coming to a town called Playa Pintada. She would have to avoid public cars or any other mode of transportation that would pinpoint her location. But she found, the closer she got, the more her resolve hardened. She would get there, and complete this troubled pilgrimage, even if she had to walk the rest of the way. How does one face a murderer? Not a socially sanctioned killer, but an actual murderer. An individual who, without the blessing of society or even its permission, permanently ends a human life. Citra knew that in the world at large, the Thunderhead prevented such things. Certainly people get pushed in front of trains, or under trucks, or off rooftops in the heat of frustrated moments, But that which is broken is always repaired. Amends are made. An ordained scythe, however, who lives outside of the Thunderhead's jurisdiction, has no such protection. To be revived is not automatic for a scythe. It must be requested. But who is there to advocate for a scythe felled by foul play? Which means that although scythes may be the most powerful humans on Earth, they are also the most vulnerable. Today, Citra vowed to be an advocate for the dead. She would deliver justice for her fallen mentor. Clearly, the Thunderhead would not stand in her way. It had given her the murderer's name. So had Scythe Curie when she had sent her on this mission. The final phase of her training. Everything rested on the actions she would take today. Playa Pintada, the painted beach. Today the coastline was strewn with large chunks of twisted, gnarled driftwood. In the dwindling sunset, they seemed like the arms and legs of terrible creatures, slowly heaving themselves out of the sand. Citra crouched behind a driftwood dragon, hiding within its shadow. A storm was moving in from the north, building over the sea and rolling inexorably toward shore. Distant lightning could already be seen, playing deep within its darkness, and thunder rolled in counterpoint to the crashing surf. She had only a handful of the weapons she had started with, a pistol, a switchblade, the hunting knife. The rest had been too hard to conceal, and so she had to cast them off before boarding the train in Buenos Aires. It was barely a day ago, yet it felt like a week. The home she watched was a single-story box of a dwelling, like many of the homes on the beach. Most of it was hidden behind palms and blooming birds of paradise. There was a back patio that overlooked the beach, on the other side of a low hedge. Lights were on inside. A shadow periodically moved behind the curtains. Citra reviewed her options. Were she already a scythe, she would glean him, following Scythe Curie's methods. A blade through the heart, quick and decisive. This was one instance where she didn't doubt her ability to do it. But she wasn't a scythe. Any lethal attack would merely render him deadish, and an ambudrone would arrive within minutes to take him to be revived. What she needed to do was incapacitate him, take him down, but not out, and then extract a confession. Was he working for another scythe or acting alone? Was he bribed like the witnesses? Was he motivated by a promise of immunity? Or was it a personal vendetta against Faraday? Then, once she knew the truth, she could bring the man and the confession to Scythe Pozuelo, or anyone in the Amazonia scythedom. That way not even Xenocrates could squelch the truth. It would clear her of any wrongdoing, and the true culprit would receive whatever punishment awaits a scythe killer. Perhaps Citra could stay here in Amazonia then, and never have to face the awful prospect of winter conclave. At the last traces of twilight, she heard a sliding glass door whoosh open, and she peered over the rough edge of the driftwood to see him come onto the patio to look out at the approaching storm. He was perfectly silhouetted against the light inside, like a paper target at a shooting range. It couldn't have made it easier for her. She pulled out her pistol. At first she leveled it right at his heart, force of habit from her training. Then she lowered it to his left knee and fired. Her aim was perfect. He wailed and went down, and Citra raced across the sand, leaped the hedge, and grabbed him by the shirt with both hands as he writhed.
"You're going to pay for what you've done," she snarled.
Then she saw the man's face. Familiar. Too familiar. Her first instinct was to think this was another layer of treachery. It wasn't until he spoke that she had to accept the truth.
"Citra?"
Scythe Faraday's face was a mask of pain and disbelief.
"Citra. God, what are you doing here?"
She let him go out of shock, and Scythe Faraday's head hit the concrete hard, knocking him out, and making the horror of the moment all the worse. She wanted to call for help, but who would help her after what she'd done? She lifted his head again, cradling it gently as the blood from his shattered knee flowed between the patio stones, turning the sand in the cracks to red mortar, drying to brown.
Immortality cannot temper the folly or frailty of youth. Innocence is doomed to die a senseless death at our own hands, a casualty of the mistakes we can never undo. So we lay to rest the wide-eyed wonder we once thrived upon, replacing it with scars of which we never speak.
too knotted for any amount of technology to repair. With each gleaning I commit, with each life taken,